Parents today act just like kids.
Did you do this to me?
Look at Dad with a sexy young co-ed. And Mom building shelves with a local handyman. Now all four of them are getting together for the weekend.
Let's go to bed.
They could use some parental guidance. Take them to see Shirley MacLaine, Anthony Hopkins, and Bo Derek.
You'd like to join me?
In A Change of Seasons, rated R.
Welcome back to Rock Under Fire. Mike DiRico here, and I'm flying solo. I'm minus my partners, my co-hosts, Patrick Ivanitsky and Stick Nixon. And for anybody just joining us, we are a rock and roll podcast exploring different periods, artists, and works of rock history comprising 7 decades. We take a different topic every episode. Not every episode is going to click with everyone, but there is something for everyone. And also what we do, there's kind of an underlying theme of the show where we kind of look at, well, what the hell happened with rock music? Why is it absent from mainstream culture? I mean, look, rock music was at one time the center, the absolute center of pop culture. It reflected politics. It reflected the state of the world. It informed fashion trends. It was the absolute center of everything. And now it is not, it's virtually non-existent. I mean, the Grammys didn't even have a rock category. I mean, they had a rock category, but they didn't televise it. It was like so insignificant. But anyway, we're available on rockunderfire.com. We're available on iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, something called Stitcher. I don't know too much about Stitcher. It's an app of some sort. Anyway, I'm reading the wiki page here for the New Jersey Hall of Fame. And it's apparently they have no permanent location here in New Jersey. But the New Jersey Hall of Fame exists as a mobile museum that tours the state. The New Jersey Hall of Fame is now on its 10th year of inductions. Began in 2008. Let's see. The New Jersey Hall of Fame selects potential nominees in 5 categories. General, enterprise, sports, arts and entertainment, and historical. So, yeah. And this year, among the 16 honorees, we have Steve Forbes, Meryl Streep, Steve Van Zandt, Debbie Harry, Al Leiter, and one of the subjects of today's episode, The Four Seasons. Now, anybody that knows The Four Seasons immediately associate it with Frankie Valli. Some people that may not know them so well but only know them through maybe Broadway will associate them with Jersey Boys, the Jersey Boys musical. Monstrously successful musical of the past 13 or so years. And part of the Four Seasons, Joe Long, their bass player and arranger for 10 years with the group from 1965 to 1975. And I mean, look, you think Four Seasons, most people, they think Sherry, they think the high falsetto, they think maybe those first 3 or 4 hits. The Four Seasons primarily started out as a vocal group. They had 1 foot in that doo-wop era. Now, doo-wop, I just want to make a note that doo-wop was not really a term that was widely used until like maybe the early 70s. In the early 70s, the 50s came back. There was a 50s revival. So in early mid-70s, you had a lot of things, all things 50s. So you had things like Happy Days and Grease and American Graffiti, Sha Na Na. You know, I keep going down the list. And the term doo-wop was coined by some DJ whose name escapes me at the moment. But they were pretty much known as vocal groups until then. The Four Seasons obviously coming out of that era, that first run of hits, including three consecutive number ones, Sherry, Big Girls Don't Cry, Walk Like a Man, in the late months of 1962. And, I mean, for the next 6 years, it was just hit after hit after hit, one of the only American acts to really rival the Beatles on the charts. Next to, obviously the Beach Boys and the Supremes, but that was it. I mean, those were like the three big American acts on the pop charts in those early and middle years of the 1960s. So, original bass player Nick Massey leaves in the summer of 1965. There's some overlap with a guy named Charlie Colello, who fills in temporarily. And then by the fall of 1965, Joe Long is on as the official bass player for the Four Seasons. And he served as their onstage arranger. He's had some co-production credits. Big role in the Four Seasons for 10 years, 1965 to 1975. Serving as their arranger, that was a big thing, because anybody that knows Frankie Valli and the history of the group knows that Frankie has always worked on stage with an arranger. And, you think the 70s, you think guys like Lee Shapiro. Well, Joe was doing that. And in recent decades, it's been Robbie Robinson. Now, Robbie Robinson is probably... He was never one of the original Seasons. He was never a Season. But he has spent, by far, more time on stage with Frankie Valli than any of the Four Seasons. I'd say we're going on like maybe 38 years. 38, 39 years, because he's been working on stage with Robbie Robinson since like 1979, I believe. So if you take him out of the equation, a lot of the seasons have come and gone over the years. Joe Long spent a full decade, so he is the longest Season. You think nice guys, the nice guy, nicest guy in the world is a cliche. You hear it all the time, but you know what? Joe Long really is the nicest guy in the world, man. I'm telling you. He really could be pissed off about a number of things. I could talk about that institution known as the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It goes unnamed. We don't talk about it by name in our conversation, but I'll mention it just at the outset here. The corrupt institution known as the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I've got so many issues with it. He's got so many issues with it. We could talk about that whole thing. And if you know the story, if you know Joe Long and you know the story of the Four Seasons, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you don't know what I'm talking about, very quickly, the Four Seasons got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1990, and Joe Long was left out simply because he was not an original member of the group. And we know with many, many, many examples that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has changed that rule and bent that rule for certain artists, and they've kept that rule for other artists. So just a hypocrisy. I don't even get me started on this. I didn't want to get started on this, and here I am talking about it. But anyway, the recognition that seems to keep passing Joe Long, and he's just one of the unsung legends of the 1960s and early 1970s. I'm glad I have him for this, because I've told him, and I've talked to him quite a few times in the past, and we've talked for hours about everything. I said, we need your voice out there. We've seen you in print. We've read interviews with you, but I want your voice out there. I want Joe Long documented in some way that's a little bit more meaningful than just reading words in print out of some newspaper interview or some magazine or internet interview. So doing this with him was really, really cool. It meant a lot as a fan of the Four Seasons, a lifelong fan of the Four Seasons. We talk about growing up in Elizabeth. We have that in common. Well, being born in Elizabeth, more so he grew up in Elizabeth. I didn't. I was just born in Elizabeth. The New Jersey connection, obviously, with this Hall of Fame, New Jersey Hall of Fame induction coming up in early May. And we kind of go through the history of the Four Seasons very briefly, touching on almost every just different changing eras, because the Four Seasons was a group that really changed and evolved with the times. And Bob Gaudio, one of the core songwriters, just, you know, really evolved with the times. He was like a sponge. Gaudio was a sponge. You know, he really soaked up all of the current trends, made them his own, put the Four Seasons stamp on it. And, you know, we go through all of that stuff and a little bit more. Joe Long, great guy. You know, we didn't get, like I said, we didn't get into any of the negative stuff. I don't know that we even touched on Jersey Boys. You know, Jersey Boys, that's the thing that a lot of people, a lot of the younger generations associate with the Four Seasons. And my own, again, I don't want to go negative on here. I can very easily go negative because, you know, while Jersey Boys is a very entertaining musical, I think that it takes liberties with history. There's a lot of historical inaccuracies there. And again, I think they had, I will say this, and maybe Joe doesn't want me to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I have, as a fan, I have a big problem with, because they had a chance, given the debacle that went down in 1990, I think they had a chance to get it right, and they blew it. They really got it wrong. You know, Joe Long was really reduced to a footnote in Jersey Boys. And that is, there's no excuse for that. I don't care that you need to take 50 years worth of a story and cram it into a, you know, some cohesive 2-hour musical or film. There's no excuse for that. Stand-up guy, Joe Long. Here's my conversation with Joe Long of the Four Seasons.
Like that, yeah. Everything that was possible to get, she got, you know?
Yeah.
And she read in the paper about a new disease.
Yeah.
And it would describe the symptoms. Well, I think I got that. You know?
Yeah, if I read about something, man, I have it. You know, if my neighbor sneezes,
right,
I go to the doctor.
Yeah.
I want to do an abbreviated version of what we did last summer, because we talked for a lot of hours last time, and I don't want, you know, I want to keep it to the New Jersey thing a little bit. You know, you are being inducted into the New Jersey Hall of Fame, and I don't want to leave out the Four Seasons, but you know, you're being inducted with the Four Seasons. We can't forget those guys. You know,
they played a little bit of a role.
A little bit, right?
Accessible.
And
that's quite an honor, Mike. Yeah, that'll be a hell of a day. We're looking forward. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I've spoken to Tommy, but because of health restrictions, he won't be able to make it out here.
Mm.
I'm going to see Frankie tomorrow, as a matter of fact.
Great.
I'll find out if he's going to be here along with Bob. I'm hoping they come. You know, I hate to be the only one there. You know, that would be kind of weird.
I think a few of them will be there. And I think Frankie's already done this once before.
Yeah. Because when he was inducted as a solo artist.
Yeah, and I got to commend the New Jersey Hall of Fame for getting it right this time, unlike that other institution that will go nameless. But that's about all I'll say of that, because I know you're sick of hearing about that. And
by the way, they don't go nameless. I have a great name for them, but I don't want to tell them.
You are a Jersey guy. Did you ever leave Jersey? I mean, did you go to Vegas for a while, or was that just Tommy?
Yeah, well, the first time I moved out of Jersey was back in 71 or 2. I think it was 71. I moved to L.A. Lived out there for a while. That's when we signed with Motown, Mo West Records, Motown Records in L.A.
Right.
And so I moved out there. I had a house there for a while, and then I moved back to Jersey, and then I moved to Vegas. And I stayed there for a number of years. Now I've been back here for about four years now, back in Jersey.
And you were born in Elizabeth, like me.
Yeah. Yep.
You spent your early childhood in Newark, right? You moved to Peterstown. Your grandmother on your mom's side had a house there.
Yeah.
Did
you do homework, or did I tell you all of this?
No, this is stuff that you've told me in the past, and I just want to, to clarify, just make sure that I was getting my own facts straight. For our show, any listeners who may, obviously, like the usual suspects are going to be attracted by this interview. So everybody that knows you. And knows everything about you and the Seasons and the whole history, but there for people who may not know.
I have no problem recounting it. It's just that I'm impressed that you were able to throw all those factoids out at me, you know.
Well, you know, I do a little bit of prep every time, you know. I have my notes spread out in front of me, so I mean, a lot of stuff is off the, you know. I mean, I could recite the entire history of the seasons off the top of my head, man. But you know, you want to be a little bit prepared when you do this kind of thing. Yeah, you know, is you want to be a little bit prepared.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad grew up on Nile Street, so he was pretty close to where you grew up. I mean, between second and third, and he graduated in 63. So, I mean, going into his senior year, I mean, he was Thomas Edison, and the seasons were the hottest group on the planet because September of 62 was the beginning of his, you know, was right when Sherry hit big, the end of August.
Right.
So, I mean, that was the beginning of his senior year. Where did you go to high school, man?
Sorry?
Where did you go to high school?
Thomas Jefferson, probably the same one he went to.
I think he was, I'm pretty sure he was Edison.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
yeah,
Edison.
It was like, Votech. You were a baseball guy, right?
Oh, yeah. I was a big baseball guy.
What was your team?
I was a first baseman.
Were you a Yankees guy?
I'm sorry?
Were you a Yankees guy?
Ever since I can remember. My father was a big Yankee fan, and somewhere along the way, he must have like threatened me. You know, when you're old enough to understand, if you're not a Yankee fan, I'll disown you. So,
oh man,
I've known
people
like
that.
I've been a Yankee fan as long as I can remember, and I'm having a lot of fun now watching these three maniacs hitting home runs all over the place. It's fun. But I've been a Yankee fan all my life, and as far as baseball, I played baseball. I played City League and County League ball, and then American Legion ball after high school. And then an accident. Well, I think we might have gotten into the accident that had to my hand.
Yeah.
That stopped, you know, not only my piano playing, but of course it stopped my baseball playing. I loved playing ball. I loved it. One of the favorite things I've ever done in my life was playing ball those few years, you know, organized, you know, in other words, not just sandlot, but, you know, playing with organized leagues.
Right. It seems like it's like they're getting earlier and earlier with the baseball season starting. It's like almost like they're trying to take the World Series.
Oh, it's nuts.
Because ever since the World Series went into November, now it's like, okay, let's move everything back.
Again in March, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. What came first before, and I don't mean in order of importance, but chronologically, what came first, sports or music?
Music, obviously. I started studying music when I was 6 years old.
Okay.
So music started first, but my participation was in baseball first because I started playing in school. I wasn't playing music professionally until I got out of high school. So although I was a musician, you know, from the tender age of 6 years old, I never put it to use really until I got out of school.
I just assumed that you were a Yankee fan because it just goes back to a quote from 60s, I guess. And when you compared, when you first joined the seasons and somebody said, well, what's it like being in front of 10,000 people, you know, and you said, well, you were one week you were working in clubs and then you were playing in front of 10,000 people and you compared it to going from the Columbus Clippers to Yankee Stadium within a week.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, maybe this guy's a Yankee fan, you know?
Yep, that's it. Yep.
But and just really briefly touching on the accident, you know, and it's almost like, I know you've spoken about that before, going back to the, you know, the Singer plant, but was that the way, were you naturally a lefty or was it the accident that forced you into playing left-handed?
Yeah, the accident forced me to play left-handed. I'm right-handed. While I was recuperating, I went through a couple of years of physical therapy, but it was a major accident, Mike. You know, it required four major surgeries to get the hand to where it is now. So it was a long time, and during that time, I kind of rekindled my interest in music, but I knew it would never be as a keyboard player. So I started self-teaching myself on bass, but I couldn't play the conventional way because, as you know, a guitar player or a bass player, the left hand is the one that does the fingering of the strings on the fingerboard, Well, I couldn't move the left, you know, the fingers on my left hand. So I was forced to learn to play it left-handed with the right hand on the fingerboard. People ask, well, was it tough switching? Well, I never had a switch, so I didn't have to worry about that. You know, I just started that way.
Yeah.
But the long-winded answer to your question, I'm right-handed, but I learned to play left-handed because of the accident.
And I want to ask you about Alphonse Strozza of the New York Philharmonic. How did you hook up with him?
Right. I wanted to, my initial goal when I really got serious about the bass was to be a concert bass player. And I was playing the upright bass at the time. And I started seeking out teachers, and somebody mentioned Mr. Strozza. He was teaching in Newark.
Oh, cool.
Jersey guy, you know, played for the New York
Philharmonic. Okay, so there was a Jersey guy.
He lived in Jersey. And so I contacted him, and sure enough, you know, he was available. And I began taking lessons with him. That didn't last too long because I realized, I mean, I lasted long enough for me to get a good foundation.
Right.
But I realized early on that concert bass was physically very demanding. It's a very physically demanding instrument to play under any condition.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're playing concert bass, I mean, you know, all the bowing, which arco in musical terms, all the arco, my left hand, which had to hold the bow, just couldn't handle it, you know. And that's when I realized I would never make it as a classical player. So I went back to my original love, which was jazz. And then from there, knowing that there wasn't enough work in jazz, I switched to Fender bass, and then, you know, rock and roll. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah. I mean, as far as that history goes, and you were a jazz guy, I guess, at the time, summer 1965.
Yeah. My first love. Yeah.
The 65, the year of love supreme. You get a call from Tommy DeVito. And,
yep.
You know, the seasons were already established. Did you know who you were talking to, or were you much of a fan? Like, how much in your awareness did the seasons lodge themselves?
I was aware of the seasons because they were having all those hits and they were a Jersey group. I can't say that I was a big fan because I was not a big fan of rock and roll music, you know?
Right.
I was playing with show groups in the area, which played rock and roll, but mostly played rhythm and blues, which is more associated to jazz. You know, the old music out of the 50s, the old Fats Domino and, you know, that era, you know, where the roots were right out of jazz music, jazz blues. So when I got the call, now Tommy called me because when they were looking for someone, musicians are a communal lot, I guess you might call them. You know, just like doctors know other doctors and lawyers know other lawyers. Well, musicians know other musicians.
Right.
And a couple of guys, you know, in fact, one of them was my then agent, Frankie Fame. Told Tommy, you know, I got a guy that is a bass player, sings, MCs, you know, does all that kind of stuff. He might be a natural fit for you. And so Tommy was curious and asked to talk to me. And Frankie brought Tommy and me together and we spoke.
I like that you gave him 2 weeks notice. You said you wanted to give your band 2 weeks notice, and Tommy wasn't taking that too well, and then he called you back.
Yeah.
And he said, "Well,
Tommy,
you know,
you got to be crazy. You know, we're giving you an offer. We're offering you a position here, and you're going to give us 2 weeks notice."
Right. It's like that in itself is commendable. You know, most people who win the lottery, you know, they don't give their jobs 2 weeks notice. They just kind of disappear. You know,
Mike. As a postscript to that story, Tommy was, you know, he was pretty bugged, you know, and so he said, "Well, okay, fine," and he hung up on me. And I remember telling my brother, "I think I just blew the best gig I could possibly have been offered."
Right.
But he talked it over with the guys, and they said exactly what you said. They said, "Well, you know, if the guy is loyal enough to have to give notice to his local New Jersey band before coming with us, well, he's not going to leave us, you know, the way Nicky did, you know."
Mm-hmm.
And I was, well, no reflection on Nicky. Nicky had his reasons, but he did leave them in a hurry. He left them abruptly. So they turned right around and called me back again. So you know, that loyalty did pay off in the long run.
Yeah, you know, because anybody else would have been like, hey, man, screw you, bye.
Yeah, right,
nice knowing you.
I got it. Yeah. And you know, and a funny aside to that was when I went to work with the band that I was at working with at the time, I told the guy, Al Natoli, who's still one of my very dearest friends, he was the leader of that group. I said, Al, I just got offered a gig by Tommy, but I told him I had to give him 2 weeks' notice, and so I think I blew it. So I said, you idiot. He said, you're fired. One of the five out of spots I could take the gig. I said, no, I can't do that to you, Al. You know, I'll give you the 2 weeks, which I did. But as I said, Tommy and the guys had a change of heart. They said, okay, you know, we'll look at that.
Look at that as a plus.
Brother's an idiot turning down a good job, but it's a guy who has loyalty, and that was great. So
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. And you were already a veteran when you got into it. So you, I mean, was
oh,
it?
Oh man, I've been playing. Yeah, I've been playing the club since the mid-50s.
So it wasn't really like, was it a shock to the system to get in front of about 10,000 people, or did it faze you at all?
It fazed me. No, although I've been working since the mid-50s, as I said, now
right.
We're looking at the early 60s. So you know, I had like 12 or 14 years of experience, but I never played for 10 or 12,000 people. I mean, you know, to me, a couple of hundred was a big audience. So that part of it, you know, gave me a jitters. But as far as playing for people, no, that I was never bothered by that because I had so much experience. I guess the first time I really got tremendous stage fright was when we first opened for Sinatra, and I thought of the impact, you know. That almost gave me a terminal case of diarrhea.
That'll do it.
Yeah. But before that, no, it never bothered me because I had so much experience doing it, you know, working for people, in front of people.
Speaking of getting into the Jersey thing a little bit, what was your favorite venue to play in Jersey? And I know there
in
was quite a few staple venues of throughout the season's history.
Well, my favorite venue in Jersey would have to be Convention Hall in Asbury Park. We went there every year for many years. I loved it. Loved Asbury Park. And my second favorite, I guess, was the Steel Pier down in Atlantic City.
Yeah.
Well, my favorite venue, you know, like all over, you know, Madison Square Garden would have to be the biggie. You know?
And you've played them all.
Yeah. We played just about every place, you know, every venue and every major venue. I know we played every major venue in the country and probably most of the secondary ones, you know.
My own personal history with you guys goes back to Convention Hall. You know, as you know, I was 4 when I first saw you guys. So, again, my parents being Four Seasons fans going right back to Sherry. They go back to they were at all of the Steel Pier shows. I hear all about the Steel Pier, you know, and my dad saying, you know, the audience, people as far as the eye can see. Yeah. So I go back to Convention Hall with you guys. So I saw you guys in 74. I'm going to say it was the summer of 74, and Stewie Stone opened up.
Yeah.
He did his act.
Oftentimes, Jane Americans opened for us as well.
And,
I just thought of something, Mike. Your father dragging you at the age of 4 to listen to the Four Seasons because he wanted to go.
Right.
And that reminded me of what I said earlier about my father. Saying, well, you'll be a Yankee fan whether you like it or not, you know.
It's true, because it really was the first.
There seems to be a relationship there, you know.
It was the first music I was exposed to. It was the first thing, you know, the first notes of any form of music I heard.
Yeah.
So it was, that's kind of cool.
Yeah,
it's definitely one of the 4 staple. I think there were 4 staple venues for the seasons in New Jersey. I played everywhere else. I played a lot of places in Jersey, but historically, in the 60s, it was the Steel Pier. In the early part of the 70s, it was Convention Hall in Asbury. And then somewhere in the mid 70s, it became the Garden State Art Center, what was then the Garden State Art Center. And that went on for about 10 to 15 years. And now it's kind of been Borgata for the last 15 years.
Yeah,
I missed
the Art Center. I left before they started playing there, so I missed that one, and of course the Borgata.
Yeah,
but
and for me it was every summer.
We couldn't play the Art Center at the time because they had an exclusivity clause that they wouldn't accept anybody who played. They wouldn't accept anybody there who played within a 50-mile radius, and of course we played Convention Hall, so they wouldn't have us until Frankie until the group stopped playing Convention Hall, and that was after I left.
Wow. That's, I never knew that. That's kind of, I don't know, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous in a way. Like, what would that be all about? I mean, it was just kind of...
Not so ridiculous then. There were a lot of places that I remember, you know, they didn't want to hire a group or an act right after a play somewhere else close by, because maybe the people that would have come to their place to see it had already seen
at the
other place, you know.
Right.
So so in some convoluted way, it makes sense, you know.
Yeah, I could see that, and it does make sense because the Convention Hall shows seem to have stopped right around the time when, you know, the group was started playing at Garden State Art Center.
Right, exactly.
You know, that's something that somebody like me would notice. Where, you know,
yeah,
when you're...
Right.
But you added, you know, going back to prior to you joining the group, the seasons, in my estimation, was primarily a vocal group. And then Nick leaves the group. You come in. You added what I think was a new musicality to the group, and where it was more, where the instrument was more of a priority, you know, it seems to me where before you, the Seasons were more of a vocal group where the song's existence, where the vocals became the reason for the song's existence, if that makes sense.
Well, I take that as a compliment, and I thank you.
You know, songs like Opus 17, Working My Way Back to You, I mean, those are 100% bass-driven songs. I mean, for me,
right.
It's the bass line that makes those songs. How much input did you have creatively at first? I mean, was it, did Bobby bounce ideas off you, or was it just like, this is the song, play it like this?
I started talking, I talked myself into a corner, but there were two avenues, there we go, two avenues. One was where the arranger would write down every part for every instrument. Now, some of those, a good example would be Can't Take My Eyes Off You. Those notes were written down by Artie Schreck, and I played them as they were on the paper. There were other songs where if the rhythm section, if the rhythm idea was spawned out of the group, well then we would play what we thought was best, and then it would bounce off the guys. So if I would play a line and Bob would say, you know, maybe you should try this, and I would try it, it would work better, so we'd use it. On the other hand, Bobby would say, here's the feel that I want, and I would say, well, you know, maybe we could do it this way. And if he thought it was a good idea, we would use it. Good examples would be like, for example, songs like Begging or Come On Marianne. Those songs were born right out of the group's traveling band, you know, road band. So a lot of those parts were generated by the musicians, but it's not to say that the other guys didn't have input as to, like, maybe modifying or fine-tuning a part.
Yeah.
So that's what happened with the bass, you know. I would be, some songs were written down, I played them the way the arranger wanted. Now, here, I've got another good example, and I know you've talked about Imitation Light Gazette. The first and last songs on that album, the ones with the big orchestras, arranged by Charlie Colallo, and everything was written down, every note. And so, obviously, the bass was written down on paper, and I read the parts. I played them as Charlie wanted them. Everything else, all the songs in the middle, in between, were my lines, and maybe touched up a little bit by Bobby, you know, or maybe Bobby's idea touched up by me. But they were all self-generated lines. So I guess that would be a good way to describe how I approached playing the bass on those records. Some of it was dictated to me, most of it was thought up as we went, you know.
Yeah, I know you have a big role in that. You have co-production credits on that album.
Yeah, well, that was my big passion, that album. I was very disappointed that a lot of things did not happen.
Yeah.
They're beginning to happen now, you know, but...
There's a lot of adjectives we can use for that album.
I really wanted it to turn out differently, but it wasn't to be, I guess.
Yeah, you know, we could say controversial, divisive, uncharacteristic of the group. There's a lot of adjectives that we can use for that album. Bobby labeled the album a failure, and yet some consider it a masterpiece. I think he's very hard on himself, honestly, just my own opinion. Regarding that record,
I don't know how current is the information you got. Does he still rate it a failure?
I've seen in print interviews where he said, and I don't know the most recent one where he referred to it as as a failure. I I'm paraphrasing, but I honestly believe he was that harsh on himself.
I have my own ideas. Back, you know, if you judged the album by the number of sales, it was a failure. Not that it didn't sell well. I mean, it still sold about 250,000 copies, I believe. That's about the number. Somewhere in the 200,000 copies sold. So, by season standards, it was a failure. So if you use record sales as your barometer, you'd have to consider it a failure.
Right.
Also, if you were to go by the impact it made on the audience, it was, again, a failure.
Right.
Our audience didn't like it. The audience that should have liked it were offended by it because they didn't like the idea of us recording something that kind of interfered with their, with their line of thinking. But now, fast forward to 10 years after the album and forward, people are more and more beginning to look at it not as an LP or as a means to appeal to an audience, but as a piece of art.
Exactly.
So now it's gaining acceptance. It seems that every year it gets more popular. It becomes more of a cult thing. And I think, with that in mind, it was a major success.
And I agree with you 100%. It's like a lot of it seemed to be like two opposing camps in the 60s, where it was like one side of the 60s that was evolving and moving on and pushing the trends, moving the trends and reacting to them, and then a lot of where they didn't really necessarily adapt to changes very well. So it was kind of like, this is too radically different.
The frustrating thing, Mike, is a lot of those people who were pushing those boundaries, as you say, did not accept us trying to do the same thing. No, you guys are just a bunch of bubblegummers from the the early 60s. So, you have no right doing that, even though they were doing the very same thing,
Yeah, so. And these are the people that have largely, going back to that institution that shall go nameless, that have largely written the story, capital S, there's the story, small s, and a big story, capital S, the story of rock and roll as it's been generally accepted, and it's just a handful of critics that I won't name that have largely written that story, and it's been, it's been handed down for the last 40, 50 years, and it's been commonly accepted, and a lot of these people have been honestly largely full of shit for the better part of the last four decades, but it just seems to me that it's like you said, one time you told me about a critic that said, if the album had been done by Moby Grape, it would have been okay,
That's such a major insult,
It's like, okay, we're not going to accept these guys because this is what these guys are in this mold.
Yeah.
They do this. They are not this. They're like trying to, while they're doing things that break boundaries and do things as art for art's sake, the album is art, that whole concept that kind of began around 66. At the same time, they're still trying to put you guys into a mold.
You love something, but say, I love it, but you have no right doing it. So if so-and-so did it, then I would really, really love it. That's crazy, man. That to me was insanity.
And what blew my mind is when you were once telling me that a lot of people, I guess, don't know is that you guys had actually prepared an entire live presentation of the album, and you had rehearsed
it. We had rehearsed it. We rehearsed the album as it was recorded. You know, the whole thing from Imitation Life to American Resurrection Crucifixion, right through Soul of a Woman. Everything, the whole album. And we were going to do it. We were going to do it on stage, present it live, then take a break and then come back and then do the hits to satisfy maybe everybody, you know.
And that seems to be a trend now. It's like a lot of artists are going back and doing your albums in their entireties. That would have been like, I don't know if that was ever done before prior to that. Like, I mean, you know, if you guys did that in 69, 70.
We would have been trendsetters.
Exactly.
There was along with the turmoil that was being churned up by the audiences, we had the same kind of turmoil that was churning within ourselves, and we just couldn't get everybody to get on board, you know.
Yeah.
So it just fell by the wayside. And once that happened, Mike, once we decided not to do it, then I remember thinking at the time, It spelled the end of that album, you know, the end of it as far as trying to make something happen with it, you know.
Yeah, that's too bad. You know, it seemed to me where Bob was writing a lot, you know, always writing for Frankie's voice. It seemed to be the first time that he was following his own intuitive needs as an artist.
Yeah. He was writing songs with no artist in mind, rather with a subject matter in mind, and that was, you know, it was great. I mean, those are, you know, he and Jake did a hell of a job. Those are some good songs, man. You know, good songs.
Absolutely. Also, Chameleon is one of my. You know, speaking of the Motown period, I don't know. It just seems to be like, you know, aside from the critics, a lot of fans of the group, you know, the Seasons never got the respect or the acclaim that they deserved. You know, and obviously that. But put that aside, it seems to me that one of the other, like the tragic flaw that kind of threads its way through the decades of the Seasons' history is kind of one bad record deal after another. And it just seems now, hear me out on this. You go through VJ, resulted in litigation. They were bankrupt. You know, the owner had a gambling problem and they couldn't even press, you know, a second run of Sherry. At the time, mm-hmm. you know, and it ended up in litigation. The Beatles, too, ended up in litigation with VJ around the same exact time, you know. You know, Frankie himself has said that the biggest regret of his career, I think he said this on Fresh Air with Terry Gross in 2007, said the biggest regret of his career was not getting the Atlantic deal in 1964.
I think that could have been a change.
Yeah. Change. You know, Phillips, obviously, you know, arguably the most prolific, successful era of the band's existence. You know, Phillips, you had a great run on Phillips. That ends up in litigation in 1970. Motown, obviously, zero promotion from Motown.
Right.
You know, Berry Gordy, you know, where he was absent and he was kind of doing Lady Sings the Blues with Diana Ross. That happens. I could go further, you know, there was private stock, you know, but it's just the tragic flaw that goes through, you know, throughout the history. And yet you guys still manage to go through the decades and be successful in each decade and, you know, carry on in the face of it, you know.
I think the Atlantic, you mentioned Atlantic Records. Atlantic was such a major force in the 60s, both in jazz and in rock. You know, they had and Erdogan and those guys. I mean, they were like pile drivers as far as getting things done. You know, it was a great, great label. I mean, look what they did with Ray Charles. I mean, you know, so many other people. And I think the group would have enjoyed a whole another success had they gone with Atlantic, because Atlantic would have handled the group differently. Would have handled the group as major stars rather than just another
That seems to, I think you just stumbled on it, like major stars, like that seems to be, you stumbled on, I think, what was happening, where by the late 60s, a lot of critics, I guess possibly even your own label, were handling you guys like you were already a thing of the past, as opposed to an evolving group. So when you tried to evolve at the times, it was largely rejected at the time.
True.
You know,
true.
I mean, if you look at the way Phillips
was totally disenchanted with Imitation Life. I don't know how Motown felt about Chameleon, but they didn't do much with it. But
I thought it was a great album.
You mentioned Chameleon, and that was another avant-garde album, another step forward. But
some of my favorite songs are on there. You know, Night, obviously the night, Touch the Rain Child, amazing, I think is. Touch the Rain Child is one of Frankie's best vocal performances. Very underrated song. Very overlooked. Mm-hmm. Should have been a hit.
Yeah. And I've always maintained that even, you know, apart from the great, great songs, the group never sounded better on record. I mean, the group just sounded so good, you know.
It was an album. It was a cohesive record, you know, beginning to end. And I think the thing with the 60s...
I'm very, very proud of Chameleon, as I am of Imitation Life.
Well, you should be. You know, I getting back to really quickly with Phillips, getting back to the Phillips years in the 60s, by the late 60s, it really seemed to me that where something like, because Chameleon and Imitation Life Gazette are so cohesively great beginning to end, it seemed to me that Phillips... towards 67, 68, were continuing to market you guys like it was still 1962. And what I mean by that was like, you know, where there were records, you know, you got into album as art, and they were still building records around a hit.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like
new,
like that album, that really great album that you talk, you know, with certain songs like Beggin', Come On Marianne, it was called New Gold Hits.
Yeah.
You know, and it was kind of like that would have been great, perfect in 1963. But it just seems like Phillips were, and it's gotten through you, no fault of your own as the seasons, but it just seems like Phillips
they were very much out of touch. As a group, they marketed us as a group. Their album, the way they marketed the albums was a group of hits. New gold hits.
Yeah.
You know, make sure people think of it as, oh, these are all hits.
Yeah.
Well, people weren't thinking that way as much anymore at that time.
Yeah.
People were thinking of, you know, thanks to the Beatles, people were saying, well, what's the content of this LP? I mean, I'm not interested in 11 hits or 12 hits, because if I were, I can go buy them, you know, 45s, you know. When Imitation Life came out, Phillips just had no, they couldn't, you know, well, wait a minute, you know, no hits, you know, how do we market this thing?
You know, at that point, it was another transitional period, and you know, was it a generational thing? I mean, I don't know. Were you happy about the direction that the group was taking? Where, you know, Bobby had visions of the group existing on its own, and Frankie going into a solo career. Does that have a lot to do with your decision to leave? Or
I didn't like that idea. In fact, it was, you know, one of the main riffs, you know, that I had. I just felt that Gordio was giving up on the season. Well, not giving up on the seasons, but giving up on the sound of the seasons. He wanted to just take, you know, Frankie sent him off on his own, and then take the four seasons, the four guys, and give them a new identity and send them off on their own. And I just felt that that was a mistake. Not that I wanted to say mired in 1962, I didn't believe that, but I did believe that there was an identity, that people recognized Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons as a very viable sound,
right?
As a viable entity, and you know, don't just give up on it. You know, bring it up to date. You know, make it 1975, 76, 77. You know, make it sound current. But at the same time, make people know, that's Frankie Valli and the guys, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we talked about this the last time that we spoke, but not long after I left the group, I got a call from my son's godmother. She says, hey, Frankie has a new record out. And I wasn't aware of it. And she said, it's called Uptown Girl.
Yeah, I remember this.
And when I finally heard it on the radio, I said, oh, damn. I said, Billy Joel, you know, he just did us, you know, from like in the 60s. You know, he did a record right out of the 60s.
Yeah.
He had a major number one hit with the song. So obviously that sound was not dead. That sound was still viable, was still saleable. You know?
Obviously not. Yeah, Billy Joel did that record, An Innocent Man, which the entire record was little tributes to the music that he grew up
right.
on.
And
that
he
was
he did admit that he was, you know, he was influenced by the group Uptown Girl.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
That was a deliberate attempt at, you know, channeling you guys and that four
yeah.
season sound and the falsetto and the harmonies.
Exactly.
And every, I mean, if you think about that record. If you think about that.
I just felt vindicated that that I may, you know, may have been right when I talked to Gordio about, you know, not giving up on the group.
Vindicated in the sense that that sound still sold records and could still be popular.
I wasn't going to sell records if you did it like Sherry.
Yeah.
But the falsetto against the harmony was
oh, I think that song is absolutely straight out of Sherry. I think it's got elements
yep.
of Sherry. I think it's got elements of, let's see.
I hear Hang On in there.
Yeah. I hear, what's the song I'm thinking of? Marlena, I'm thinking of. It's got elements
yep.
of
yep.
so many things. It's almost like he chopped up little, like four or five season songs, put it in a blender,
yeah.
and Uptown Girl came out. You know, but it was deliberate. So it's not like, you know, he did it as a tribute. So it's kind of like, and you know what was kind of
yeah.
cool, which I saw on YouTube, Frankie actually did the song in a tribute to Billy Joel. It was some kind of televised Billy Joel show. So that was kind of cool. This New Jersey Hall of Fame thing. Are you looking forward to it or what?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very honored. It should be a great day. For a lot of people, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You're in some
seasons. I mean, Meryl Streep is being inducted that day, and Steve Van Zandt is being inducted.
Yeah.
Deborah Harry.
Right.
And other people in other walks of life, you know.
Uh huh. Al Leiter, who spent some time with the Yankees and the Mets.
That, huh?
You know, Steve Forbes, Gloria Gaynor. And I think this is the 10th year of the New Jersey. Now, the New Jersey Hall of Fame is kind of like, does it actually exist anywhere, or is it just kind of still this floating idea? Like,
that's a good question. I don't know.
I don't think it exists yet.
I'm not aware of any actual place.
Yeah,
place. So
it's,
I don't know. It may just be in the minds of everybody. You know?
Yeah, you know, and...
That's okay. I mean, I know that we're joining... You know, we're joining the likes of Frank Sinatra and John Bon Jovi, the Boss, isn't that? You know,
yeah,
they're all in there. You know,
yeah.
And us. So that feels good.
It's a big event format. You know, you're all day long. It's like, you know, you got the inductee cocktail reception. I'm looking at this. It's 3:30 to 4:30. Now everything is like perfectly timed here. You know, so you're going to be on a schedule, Joe. You're going to have to get up early.
They got us on a tight schedule.
The cocktail reception for family, you know, is followed by the dinner reception. So you see the inductees and the presenters and the board of trustees and the governor and all that, you know. And then you got this general reception that's going on in Convention Hall at the same time as you guys are having dinner. And then you got the red carpet arrivals and the induction ceremony at the Paramount. And then you got the after party at the Wonder Bar. See, I'm telling everybody for this who wants to crash the party later on. So
it should be fun.
Do you ever get over to Asbury these days, or you know, because the last time I was there,
I'm there usually two or three times a year, because right across from Convention Hall is McClune's Supper Club, and the band that I've been mentoring plays there two or three times a year. So I'm down there, you know, at least that many times a year. Yeah.
I don't get there that much, but every time I go there, I mean, I was there maybe three times in the past, let's say 15 years, and I can't believe...
Go back, Mike. They've rebuilt it. It's,
I can't believe
really
how much...
They're doing a nice job of bringing it back.
Yeah. It was very active when I went there. It was like a few years ago, but it was all built up. And prior to that, it was like 2003 or 2004, where I went down there and it was just deserted, and it was just like ruins. Like, you literally had the ruins of the old, you know, the carousel... And that whole thing. And
well,
I remember
the
thinking
it was a ghost town for a number of years, but it's they're doing a nice job of bringing it back. Really, they really are doing a nice job.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What was like Asbury Park?
That was our vacation spot. I remember being like three years old and going to Asbury Park for, you know, it was still very much active. There were rides, you know, if you were a little kid, you go on the rides, you know. Now it's like we go to Wildwood, you know. I kind of got back into the habit of going to Wildwood every summer with my nephew, who is now four, who incidentally plays, you know, he's into the guitar. And he's got a couple of toy guitars, and he holds it lefty. And I'm like, okay, you know, Uncle Mikey is gonna teach him guitar, but Uncle Mikey has no way of playing lefty, you know. So it's like I gotta talk to my friend Joe, you know.
We need more left-handed guitar players than bass players in this world.
Regarding the New Jersey Hall of Fame, it's going to be a full and festive night, my friend. And congratulations to you. Congratulations to you. Congratulations to the group.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for taking the time to talk to me about this. It's always great to talk to you, Joe.
Yeah, same here, Mike, and hope we'll do it again soon.
Mike DiRico for Rock Under Fire signing off. We're out of here.
Bad news keeps pouring on me. Bad news keeps pouring on me.